Then you wouldn't have begun. So why do people go?
It's very interesting. Right. So why do people go? It's like very strange. And people love going. So I did a informal, unscientific survey of several people who go. I wouldn't call them friends. Acquaintances of mine who actually go to these games. And I asked them, what is it? Why do you go? And they said, all of them said, it's not just the football. It's being together with 80,000 screaming fans. All together, screaming for the team, going for the team. That was the phenomenon. It's very interesting. So there is something about it which is not about the football per se, but it's about being together with a bunch of other people, doing something together, being part of a tremendous and great unity. And we find that people do crave and desire this. Another example of this would be the famous phenomenon which sociologists call bageling. You familiar with a bagel? Bagel as a noun. I'm talking about bagel the verb. I bageled you, you bageled me, we all bageled each other. No, you're not familiar with this? Okay, so a little vocabulary here, right? Someone can do it in French later. But bagel is the following phenomenon. If someone who looks obviously Jewish, like myself, someone who is not obviously Jewish, when they come within approximately 4 foot of me, will feel an overwhelming urge to identify themselves as Jewish by some random phrase in Hebrew or Yiddish, like happy Yortzeit or something like that. Right? Anyone ever been bageled? Yeah? Right? Happens all the time. I was leading a tour group in Budapest, and walking along the street there with a group of tourists, my students who I was taking along in Hungary, and a fellow comes over to me and says, excuse me sir, but do you know how to get to the open air market? I said, yes, end of Vati Utska, make a left towards Dohani Street, and you'll see it on the right. He says, thanks very much, and he looks around and he says, wouldn't want to be wandering around for 40 years like last time. That was a bagel. That was a bagel. I was in Harrods in London, and next to me was an upper crust English couple. The guy was actually wearing a silk cravat, looked something out of Armchair Theatre or something. It was unbelievable. He and his wife are looking at some object art, surreptitiously glancing in my direction every now and again. And I said to myself, I could feel a bagel coming on. The guy says, right, he says, Harriet, and she says, yes, George, and he says, oy vey, this is quite expensive. The guy didn't say oy vey since his bris. I mean, this is a bagel. It's a very nice bagel. It was a bagel. There can be group bagels. I was leading a tour in China, been there 3 times. We're in Shanghai, the Imperial Tea Gardens or something like that. And there's a large group of us, mostly religious Jews from Brooklyn. We were literally the loudest thing in Shanghai at that time. You know, you can imagine the NSA satellites saying, what's going on in Shanghai? Right, but anyway, so as we're walking, a group of people of vaguely Middle Eastern appearance comes towards us, and apparently they were Israelis, because as soon as they saw us, they started singing the worst Jewish song in history, Hava Nagila. I will forgive them for it because it was a very nice group bagel. Right? I was actually in the subway in New York, and there was a guy who was playing on his violin Mozart Eine Kleine Nacht music, which I was enjoying tremendously. And I turned around to see that if the train was coming. He sees my yarmulke. He switches to Hava Nagila. I said to him, I was going to give you $1, you anti-Semite. Now I'm not going to give you a cent. So the phenomenon of bageling is a very similar sociological phenomenon. Here are people who want to join with a larger group. I want to identify as Jewish. Instead of the person screaming and saying, I am Jewish, ich bin a Yid, or something like that, they will say whatever they said, oy vey, or sing Hava Nagila, or whatever it is. That is called bageling. And that is a phenomenon. And a lot of people do this, not just Jews. A lot of people, I don't know what Catholics call it, wafering or something. I have no idea. But either way, right? transubstantiation. I don't know, but a lot of people do this, and it is a desire to join with this large unity, very similar to going to the Denver Rocking Horse game, right? To going to the Jets, etc., etc., right? And it's a similar phenomenon. So sociologically, and one more and fairly obvious one, is that many, many people, a lot of the world's population, try to create a unity with one other person. One other person. Their spouse. They try to find a spouse, they try to create their unity. Not everyone is successful, but a lot of people put a lot of time, a lot of effort, a lot of money, a lot of blood, sweat and tears into trying to become one with one other person. It's an amazing phenomenon. So a friend of mine, he's told me his wife just walked out on him. I said, what happened? She said she was going to get milk, never came back. I said, oh my God, how are you getting on? He says, you know, we've got creamer at home, so coffee's okay. Right. But we do spend a lot of time trying to unite with one other person. I remember, you know, when I asked my wife, so Javi, would you like to get married? She said, sure, to whom? So, took a while, but eventually she agreed on me. But maybe something to do with this research she was doing in abnormal psychology at the time. But anyway, so that is phenomenon number one, sociological. That is to say, we try to get together with large groups, we feel something pulling us to have that unity with a whole bunch of other people. We try to identify with the Jews, or, you know, maybe with someone of your own ethnicity or language group, or so on and so forth. Very common thing. People want to join with that larger unity, that larger oneness. And of course, marriage, love, etc., which is another example that Aristotle called marriage, one soul in two bodies. In an ideal level, that's what it should be, how Aristotle put it. And so, that is as far as sociology goes. Let's move to science. So in science, a lot of science is based on trying to string together different phenomena and find the thread that ties them all together. Is that not so? You plot dots on the graph and you take a magic marker and we try to draw the line. What is the algorithm? What is the formula? What is the equation that joins them together? What is it that unites everything? One of the great advance of science, the great advances of science over the history, has been based on the idea that things are actually connected. That there is a certain, as in the words of Stephen Hawking, that there's a certain underlying order to nature, which may or may not be divine, but an underlying order there is. And the search for that is the engine that drives so much of science. It's interesting, let's say you would have someone who's a polytheist. Polytheist meaning poly, many, theos, gods. Polytheist means someone who believes in many gods. I remember we were talking about this at the Shabbat table in our house. One of my kids, who was about 9, I think, at the time, he says, polytheist? I said, yeah, you know, many polytheos gods. He says, oh, is that where politics comes from? I said, go on. He said, well, poly is many, and ticks are small blood-sucking parasites. So. Etymology and entomology meeting at the Becher table. It was very beautiful. So the polytheist would look at the world, and perhaps he's in some island, let's say Polynesia, somewhere in there. And this person notices a earthquake. Maybe there's also a volcano. Maybe there's a tsunami. Will he connect them? Probably not. The earthquake is because they did not drop a goat into the crevice outside the village last Monday. And the volcanoes, because they didn't chuck a lady and the diving board was broken, so there was no sacrifice to the volcano god, etc. And the tsunami, nothing to do with this, it's the sea god. Polytheism divides up everything into a separate sphere of power, light and darkness, and good and bad, and everything is, it's division. That is what polytheism is. Avodah Zarah, idol worship. Idol worship. It's interesting. The Talmud, one of the phrases the Talmud uses for idolatry is kotseitz b'netiot, which means cutting off the saplings from the source. It's cutting things off from the source of oneness, the source of unity. So the Gemara, the Talmud, actually tells us you should not speak to a pagan priest. Because, as Rashi tells us, Rashi, of course, the great medieval commentary on the Talmud. Remember, one of my kids came home from school, asked, "What did you do today?" He said, "Nothing." It's usually true. And I said, "No, come on, tell me something." He said, "We learned about Rashi." I said, "What did you learn about Rashi?" He said, "We learned that he lived during recess." I said, "What the heck did the rabbi say?" He said, "I don't know." He said, "Rebbe said that Rashi lived from 1140 to 1105. So... I said to my wife, "Javi, don't bother buying that little sticker on the car. My son is an honor student. It's not going to happen." Anyway, but Rashi tells us, because the way that that pagan priest called a magi, the way he looks at the world, everything he says is influenced by his polytheistic view. Because he doesn't unite anything together. One of the great advances, and it's interesting, as James Barbour in his book on the philosophy of science, Barbour tends to think, and I think he might be correct here, that a lot of the advances of Western science was a result of it coming from a monotheistic milieu, from the view of the world as having one God, the view of the world as having one origin. Means that you are going to look for oneness. You're going to look for unity. And guess what? When you look for it, you actually do find it. Things do actually fall into place. You can actually connect the dots. You can find a formula that makes sense of things. You can find the underlying order of the world. It's an amazing thing. There's a certain elegance to the world, a certain oneness. There's actually an idea. One of the great philosophers of science from England, Ockham, William of Ockham. Sorry, call him Bill the Ocker. But William of Ockham had this idea that you have to reduce, your best explanation is going to be the one where pluralities are reduced. Cut out all the stuff which is extraneous until you can get the most unified possible simple explanation for everything. And indeed, I believe that that comes from a monotheistic worldview. The success, even scientists who are atheists, agnostics, etc. But their mind has been educated, and they come from a culture and a milieu which has had thousands of years of monotheistic worldview. You can't escape that. And because of that, I think it has had a positive and amazing impact. Maimonides begins his book, the Mishneh Torah. That was his great 14-volume work with all of Jewish law. He says, actually, that you only need two books to be a good Jew, now that he's written it. You need the Tanakh, the Torah, the written Torah, and you need my book, Mishneh Torah. He says, you'll know exactly what to do. No exaggeration. That is actually true. Of course, it's 14 volumes. We have available here the one-volume Gateway to Judaism. But it's quite deep. You need to read it twice. So I suggest buying two copies. So, if you have a chavrusa, four. But anyway, but he says in the beginning of this 14-volume work, Maimonides says the following: Yisod ha-yisodot, the foundation of foundations, the amud ha-chochmot, and the pillar of all wisdom. Ladat is to know, sheyesh sham matsui rishon, that there is a first being, God. Maimonides, I understand, he says, the foundation of foundations, that is the foundation of all of Judaism, is the knowledge that there is a God. But he goes a little further than that. He says, it's amud ha-chochmot, the pillar of wisdoms, all wisdom. He was a man of science, he was a philosopher, physician, etc. And the pillar of all wisdom is that knowledge. Because I think what he is alluding to here is this concept that the search for unity will find unity, because there is an inherent unity in the world because it is created by the one God. And so therefore, in sociology we have the search for unity. In science we have the search for unity. Two of the things that physicists are searching for are their gut and their toe. The gut meaning GUT, grand unifying theory, and the toe, theory of
everything.
Okay. And the assumption is there should be something like that. Why? Albert Einstein wrote in a letter to a friend of his, Morris Solovine, he wrote in the letter, he says, you know, The most incomprehensible thing about the universe is the fact that it's comprehensible. It's weird, isn't it? Right? Why should it be understandable to the human mind? Why should mathematics work? Why should we be able to understand? But we do, and I believe that is because it is created by a wisdom of God, is created by one God, and he has endowed us with intelligence. He has endowed us with a search and with the ability to find that truth. And so we do seek out oneness. We do seek out oneness in relationships, in sports games, in mathematical formulae, in explanations of the world. We do seek this out, and we tend to find it. Not always, but we tend to do this. And now we come to the Torah aspect of this. And we find this very fascinating. With what letter does Genesis begin in Hebrew? Anyone? Base. Bereshit. Second letter of the alphabet. I would have thought, had I been writing the Torah, an idea which I had that Arskroll rejected, together with my illustrated Al-Khait. I may self-publish on that one. But anyway. The Torah starts not with the letter Aleph, the first letter of the alphabet, but it starts with the second letter of the alphabet. That's a strange way to start. Start with an Aleph. I mean, God could have figured out a way to start with the letter Aleph, one. And the Gemara discusses, the Medrash discusses this, and the Medrash says a very interesting idea. It says the following. It says the reason the Torah starts with Beit, the letter 2, the second letter in Hebrew, as you know, there are no numerals. So it's Beit, right? It's not like in Rome in Latin, there's no numerals either, right? Here's another one. Right? A Roman walks into a bar and says, give me 5 beers, please. Right. Oh, sorry, make it 4. Right, anyway, so same guy asks for a Martinez as a chaser. Bartender says, you mean a martini? He says, if I want 2, I'll tell you. So in Hebrew, we don't have numerals. We use the letters of the Hebrew alphabet are numbers. So Beit, second letter, is also the number 2 in Hebrew. And creation begins with the number 2, not with the number 1. And the reason for that is, according to the Midrash, the Maharal, and the Ramchal, Rav Moshe Chaim Lozato, is because creation was the beginning of division. I.e., before creation, God's oneness is obvious, is apparent, and that's all there is. Once he creates the world, there is the illusion of separation. Me and you. Us and them. Us and him, creator and creation. There's separation. In fact, the only day of creation, of the 6 days of creation, the only day where it does not say ki tov and it was good, is day number 2. Because on day number 2 there was separation. The water above, water below. So 2 is the number of separation. Because when God creates the world, automatically there is going to be some level of separation between the creator and the created, between us and God. And so Beit is that letter of creation. It is the creation of Tunis, not Tunis in North Africa, but Tunis with a W. It is plurality. And that plurality, and what is the purpose of all of creation? Rav Moshe Chaim Lozato, the great Italian Jewish Kabbalist from Padua in Italy, born in the early 18th century, Rav Moshe Chaim Lozato tells us our job, and the job of all of humanity ultimately, is to get from the base, the 2, back to the Aleph, to the 1. That from two-ness to create oneness. We see this, for example, that when God created the human being, Ha'adam, the verse that describes creation is a very strange verse. It says, and the Lord God created Adam, humans, in his image. In the image of God he created him, male and female he created them. So in the same verse in which the Torah tells us Adam's creation, it describes him as one, and yet then it says, male and female he created them. So was Adam male, female, both? I mean, right? I don't want to get too politically correct here, but I mean, you know, how did he self-identify? Actually, I was driving here behind a large pickup truck, belching smoke. I mean, it was unbelievable. And on the back, I had a large sticker which says, "I self-identify as a hybrid." So, anyway, so Adam, the Talmud says, in the Gemara in Yevamot, the Talmud says that Adam was both, the original human was both male and female. And where the creation of Adam and Eve was actually a division, a splitting up of that unity into two parts. And then God says to them, "V'hayu lebasar echad," they'll become one flesh once again. So I remember one of my kids asked, "Well, if you want them to be one, why split them apart?" I mean, they already were one. The answer here, Rav Moshe Chaim Luzzatto gives, is that it's only meaningful if we do it ourselves. So God creates the potential of oneness, then he splits it up, he creates bait, two, and then he tells us two, from that two-ness, he wants us to create oneness and to unite once again. And that is really the whole purpose of creation, is to create oneness in the midst of plurality. There is a beautiful story in the Talmud tractate Shabbos, which you probably are familiar with parts of the story, in which three Gentiles approach Shammai and Hillel. They want to convert. So one of them says, "I'd like to convert, but on condition that I become the high priest." Shammai says, "There's the door. Goodbye." Hillel says, "No worries, mate. I think we can organize this." And he teaches him about Judaism, and the guy realizes he can't be the high priest, but he becomes a good Jew anyway. Second comes in and he says, "I'd like to study Judaism. I'd like to become Jewish, but I only want to keep the written law. Forget this whole oral law stuff." Shammai chucks him out. Hillel says, "No worries, mate." And he becomes a good Jew. The third is the most famous. Right, the third, I'm sure you've heard. The third comes to Shammai and says, "Teach me the Torah while standing on one foot." Right, I don't have time. Is it my imagination, or is it slightly warm in here? It is warm. Is it? Maybe is it air conditioning? Is that not ecologically friendly? Okay, all right. Anyway, whatever. So I thought I was coming down with a fever, but there's, okay. So where was I? Yeah. So Shammai is technically correct. Right, if the guy doesn't have time to, I mean, seriously, while standing on one foot, I want all of Judaism on one foot. Maimonides actually writes in the introduction to Guide for the Perplexed, not in the introduction, so we're in the first section, Guide for Perplexed, he actually says, if you would tell most people, you tell them, listen, would you like to know why you exist? Why there's a world? What is the soul? What's the purpose of life? What happens after life? Most people will say, yes, totally. Maimonides says, you tell them, okay, this might require a week. They say, "I think I don't have a week." He says, "You'll tell them, how about a day?" "Oh, no, no. How long do you want? Can you do it in 10 minutes? Seriously?" Right, but so it's not a new phenomenon. It's an old phenomenon. And this non-Jew wanted the whole Torah while standing on one foot. Shammai said, "Not prepared to do that. Get out." Hillel says, "I can do that." And Hillel famously says to him, he says, "Mad'aleich sanei l'chavreich lo sa'avid. That which is hateful unto you, do not do unto your friend. Hadar perushahu, the rest is commentary. Zil gmor, go and learn." Fascinating. So Hillel encapsulates all of Judaism in one statement. What does he say? That which is hateful unto you, don't do unto your friend. And most people, I think, ignore the second part of what Hillel said. What's the second part of what Hillel said? The rest is commentary on this, go and learn. Now, how is the rest of it, of the Torah, commentary on that? I understand that which is hateful unto you, don't do unto your friend, is a very important principle. Yes. How is the rest of the Torah a commentary on that? How is don't eat lobster a commentary on that which is hateful unto you, don't do unto your friend? I mean, unless your best friend is a salamander or a lobster. The immortal words of the poet. Right? I mean, how is that? How is it relevant? How is not eating on Yom Kippur, that which is hateful unto you, don't do unto your friend? How is keeping Shabbat, that which is hateful unto you? Hillel doesn't just say that this principle is an important principle. It is. But he says this, the whole Torah is a commentary on this principle. How is the Torah a commentary on this principle? Very strange. So Rashi gives us a little bit of an opening into this. And Rashi says, when it says that which is hateful unto you, don't do unto your friend, he says you have to expand the concept of friend a little further. Who else is called your friend, other than your fellow human being, your friend? Who else is called your friend? So the verse tells us, Re'acha v're'a avicha. It describes God as our beloved, our friend. There's a very beautiful song we sing on Shabbat, Yedid Nefesh Av Harachaman. Describes God as the merciful Father, but it also describes Him as Yedid Nefesh. What does Yedid Nefesh mean? Close friend. The word Yedid in Hebrew is the closest, is a close friend. Yedid, close friend. Why? What is it composed of? The word Yedid, Yud Dalad. Yad Yad, it's two hands, one whom you embrace with both hands. You know, when it comes to a student, you push away with the left, draw close with the right. You have to have a certain distance. Okay. So, but when it comes to a friend, Yad Yad, both hands embrace. You draw close with the, there is no pushing away whatsoever. God is described as Yedid Nefesh, the beloved, the friend. As we would say in Australia, the cobber, the mate of the soul. An idea, an Australian translation of the Siddur. Okay, I have to think about that. Okay, right. Yeah. So God is described as our friend. And who else is your friend? Rav Moshe Chaim Luzzatto, great Italian Kabbalist, says you, meaning when I say you or I consists of my body, my personality traits, my abilities, my idiosyncrasies. I'm a little weird, I have no idiosyncrasies whatsoever, right? But my idiosyncrasies, all of that, that's me. But I have a soul. He says the closest friend you have is your soul. Soul is the closest friend. So now, let's look back at Hillel. Hillel says, what is the foundation of the entire Torah, all of Judaism? That which is hateful unto you, don't do unto your friend. And yes, all friends. Meaning, if everything I did, all of the Torah is a commentary on that concept. How do you live in such a way that which is hateful unto me, I don't do unto my fellow human being? What we call mitzvot bein adam l'chaveiro, mitzvot between man and his friend, or woman and her friend, or whatever, right? That adam l'chaveiro, right? We have a second category, mitzvot that are designed to create a unity between ourselves and God. Bein Adam l'makom, between a person and God. And there's a third category. Bein Adam l'atzmo, unity within the self. That my thought, speech and action should be in sync, in consonance with each other. Very, very negative, uncomfortable if your beliefs and thoughts are not coordinating with your actions and vice versa. If what you believe you can't say, if what you say you don't believe, if what you believe and say you cannot do, if what etc. etc. Very rough. What we'd like to have is my actions, my thoughts, beliefs, and my speech are all completely unified. And unity with other people and unity with God. That's what Hillel is saying. Hillel said to this Roman Gentile who came and he said, I want the whole Torah on one foot. Hillel said, yeah, I'll give it to you on one foot. That which is hateful unto you, don't do unto your friend. Just expand the definition of friend a little bit. Beyond fellow human being. That's important. And God and yourself. That really, I've just given you, this is the essence of all of Judaism. The essence of all of Judaism is go from the Beit back to the Aleph. Go from two back to one. Whether it's in interpersonal relations with other people, whether it's within your own self, whether it's between you and God. As we know, and we have commandments, 613 commandments. The 613 commandments govern and direct us in all of these three areas. Don't get worried. I see people like, oh, 613. No one is obligated in all of them unless you are single and married, Kohen, Levi, Yisrael, male and female, all simultaneously. I'm sure in California there are entire communities like that. Vast majority of us, we're not obligated in all of them, but nevertheless, those 613 commandments are there in order to create, to promote, to enhance that unity between myself and other people, within myself, and between ourselves and God. And that is what Hillel's telling us. That is the bait that comes back to the Aleph. How do you accomplish this? So our understanding of self has to expand. Rav Shimon Schop, very great Talmudic sage from the 20th century in Europe, Rav Shimon Schop, in an introduction to one of his works, discusses this. And he says, you know, I find it a little interesting, because he says, love your neighbour as yourself, be concerned with the other always. Doesn't that seem to contradict basic human instinct? Self-preservation? Right? I love, you know, self-love. Not only that, but according to Jewish law, if it's a question of my life versus someone else, I'm supposed to put my life first. Like, if you're hiking with me and you lose your water, sorry. Right, not going to share it. Right, I mean, it's nothing personal. It's just my life comes first. Right, a lot of people in New York and New Jersey drive like that, basically. They prefer that you die rather than merge. Right. Nothing personal. Just the way it is. Yeah. I mean, I put on my indicator, and basically that causes all traffic to accelerate to close up any gap. Could possibly get in, you know that? I drive in Australia, I put on my blinker, a gap opens up in the traffic so I can merge. I didn't merge! I thought it was a trap. Been in New York for so long and I don't trust anyone. And it's like, I'm not going to move. So Rav Shimon Schop says that, but there is a legitimate, it's legitimate legally, morally, to be concerned with my own life. Right? That's okay, nothing wrong with that. It's legitimate to have self-love. That's legitimate. He says, so how does that work with the obligation to always want to love the other? That which is hateful unto you, don't do unto the other. So he says the following. He says, the answer is, you have to change your understanding of self. Example. When a person's on the lowest possible level, a baby, very minimum consciousness in terms of self-consciousness, they don't even realize their entire body is theirs. You know what I mean? Their entire consciousness is focused on their mouth. You know what I mean? At a certain point, they see their foot move and they say, oh, you know, like, whoa, I did that, man, right? And they start to have an awareness of the entire body as part of the self. But he says, as the child gets older, they begin to realize that the self also is not just the mouth and the nerve endings, but it's also the mind. They'll also be starting to ask questions, why, and what, and where, etc., to satisfy the mind. As you get a little older, you begin to realize not just the intellect, it's also the soul that needs satiation. That the self has expanded, not just the body, not just the intellect, but also the soul. When you have a loving relationship with someone, you begin to understand that also self includes those people whom I love. Right? When I say, when I go to the car lease guy, it was a while ago, I said to him, listen, I need a 8-seater minivan. He looks me up and down, he says, look, Rabbi, you could lose some weight, but I think you could fit in a regular car. I said, listen, idiot. When I say 8-seater, I meant for my wife and family, you know what I mean? It's not like I need, you know, a minivan modified to get my huge bulk in there, you know what I mean? I personally would get a small sports car, right? But you see, when I say I need, what do I mean by I need? My family. That's I. Sometimes you get to a point where you realize that I also means the whole Jewish people. Right? When we think about, right, you know, I say to someone, how are you doing? He says, not good. I say, what's wrong? He says, well, look what's happening. Israel with the Gaza protests, the incendiary balloons. Yeah, that's me as well. I'm part of that. That's part of the I. We are part of that. There's a great, in halacha, Jewish law, there's a principle, Kol Yisrael Arevim Zebazeh. You ever heard that principle? All Jews are responsible one for the other. The Ritva, Rabbi Yontov Ben Alashbili, one of the great Spanish medieval commentaries, the Ritva writes, he says, because we are all like one body. So if we're all one body, of course we're responsible for each other. I just want to tell you, I was in Israel with my wife and I. We first, just before we got married, so my wife found an apartment to rent in Kiryat Moshe. Beautiful little neighborhood in Jerusalem, not far from the central bus station. We found an apartment, two-bedroom, she found, a two-bedroom apartment that was going for $200 a month. Wow. It's a long time ago. You cannot get this. Forget. You could cry. Right, $200 a month. And because we were new immigrants, the government was paying $175 a month of that. As long as we stayed in Israel more than 5 years, which we did. In Israel, 15 years. Right? So, however, we needed to get guarantors. We needed to get people who have sufficient income, Israeli citizens, etc., employed, who were prepared to sign that if the Bechers leave before 5 years is up, they will pay back all that money that the government gave us for the loan. So we found four people, and we had to show, we had to get the document, you know, stamped at the bank and show it to the landlord in order to get the apartment that afternoon. So we went to the bank, Bank HaPoalim in Binyan Klal on Rehov Yafo, and we walk into the bank and we have the four guarantors all signed. And then they leave, and then we're sitting there, and the clerk says, "Where's the fifth guarantor?" I said, what fifth guarantor? She said, "Well, you know, you need fifth, you need five." I said, "No, we only need four." She said, "Who told you need four?" I said, "The aliyah shaliach, the, you know, the person who helps you make aliyah." She said, "Where is he?" I said, "Melbourne, Australia." She said, "I'm here, and I have the stamp. I say you need five." So I started crying, my wife started yelling at her, or the other way around, whatever, right? And we need to show the apartment this afternoon, etc. We get the apartment, and like, oh my God, it's terrible. And a guy walks by, someone I'd never met before, I did not know his name, didn't know him, complete stranger, walks by, he sees what's going on, he walks over and he says, "Ma Baya, what's the problem?" So I said, we need five guarantors. We need to get the apartment this afternoon or we lose it. We need to show these." He says, "I'll sign." He says, I have a cheshbon. I have an account in this bank." He says, "I'll sign as your fifth." I said, "You don't know me. I don't know you." He says, "Asma, so what?" He said, "Kol Yisrael arevim ze baze. Every Jew is a guarantor, one for the other. Let it be in writing." And he signed as the guarantor, fifth guarantor. Amazing, right? That is someone who takes this seriously, right? In the understanding, he says, we are part of one unit. So that understanding means that I've expanded the self to include others. And Rav Shimon Shkop says, you know, on the highest level, not just the Jewish people, but on the highest level, person understands that all of reality, I am part of and we are part of that. As John Donne, the great poet from England, put it, "No man is an island entirely of itself. Every man is a part of the continent, a piece of the main." He disagreed with the great Jewish poets. He was Catholic, but I agree with him here. The Jewish poets, Simon and Garfunkel, who said, "I am a rock, I am an island." Right? We disagree with them. I think they're wrong, right? John Donne is right. We are not a rock or an island. We are part of that whole. And that really is what the Torah is all about. The Torah is all about creating, enhancing, and moving us from the bait of creation, the two-ness, back to the aleph of creation. We do that through the mitzvot. We do that through gathering together. We do that through Torah study. The fact that we are all gathering together here, the fact that we are learning Torah together, the fact that we are socializing, the fact that we are seeing old friends and new friends, etc., is part of that incredible, incredible search for unity and the incredible approach to unity. And may it be that we all move from the bait back to the aleph, and that this Yarchei Kala, which we are starting tonight officially, should be a wonderful, wonderful experience of unity between us and God, us and other people, and within ourselves also, the unity of the body, the soul, thought, belief and practice, because that's really what we all want. And when we get back to that final unity, each individual, then the whole world also gets back from the bait to the aleph and experiences. We say at the end of every single time we pray, every single time we get together for prayer, we end with the words, "Bayoma hu yihyeh," on that day, Hashem Echad, God's one, V'shmo Echad, and His name, meaning every manifestation of God's will, His name, us, me, you, etc., all will be part of that oneness, and that is really what we look forward to and pray for every single time we pray. Thank you very much for listening. I'm I'm happy to take questions. Like, I'm type of like reminder of what was that guy's name? The famous serial murderer in America, crazy guy Sharon Tate and stuff. Charles Manson. I saw an interview with him in prison. You know, so a reporter's interviewing him. He's sitting there with his manacles on. He's going like this. And the guy says, "You okay, Mr. Manson?" He says, "Am I crazy or is it hot in here?" I feel a little bit like Charles Manson, but okay. Yeah. Any questions? Heckling, alternate speeches, political statements, endorsements? Yes.
First of all, thank you, Rabbi, for coming and welcome to Ottawa. I overheard someone quoted a certain well-known rabbi, a famous rabbi, who was asked by a Gentile if the stories like Adam and Eve in Gan Eden in the Bible are to be taken as actually having happened. And his answer was...